Good evening, America. Welcome to It Just Calls Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Ethel Lopez and Cliff Stewart. We bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Cliff and Ethel, how you guys doing?
Wonderful.
Yep, good to be back in the fold again.
Awesome.
Missed you guys on Tuesday, but ready for another round here tonight.
Okay. Let's do the disclaimer. Cliff, Ethel, and I are not attorneys, and A Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. Please contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, we want to thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening. Our call-in number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. This evening, we will, on the previous program, we had an excellent program talking about the raid on IRP Solutions Corporation. So, you know, we're going to continue that.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who want to find out a little bit more about IRP Solutions and the story, you can go to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org. You can go to our website as well, a-justcause.com, a-justcause.com. And then for our radio program schedules, you can go to ajcradio.com. So, Ethel, tell us a little bit about what we're doing as far as, you know, folks who have been following the program know about the 200 pages of transcript that Judge Arguello has been withholding.
Yes.
And so give us a little background on that and what we need to do.
Well, over 200 pages of transcript that Judge Arguello and Darlene Martinez have been holding. We want people to contact Attorney General Eric Holder's office and ask him to investigate this over 200 pages of missing transcript. Give him a call at 202-514-2003 and 2005. Something's got to be done here. We've got six men sitting in prison, wrongly convicted, and over 200 pages of the transcript is missing.
And also, we have a petition out on change.org for that same thing.
Absolutely.
And so, you can go out to change.org, put in a search on IRP6, again, IRP6, and sign that petition. Sign it tonight while we are on the air. One other thing we want you to do is, you know, we are trying to get some donations going here at A Just Cause Coast to Coast, because the work that we are doing requires some financial backing, to be quite frank about it.
Absolutely.
And so go to our website, a-justcause.com, a-justcause.com. There is a donate button on the website. Click that button and help us out. You know, we are currently working on our 501c3 designation. So as of right now, it would not be a tax-deductible donation. But if you believe in the cause, do it.
Absolutely.
And then once you make a donation, you know, jump in the chat room, give us a call or whatever, and let us know that you did it and why you did that.
And make sure that you know that this program is not just about the IRP 6. This is about people, period, that have been wrongly convicted, sitting in prison and don't have a voice, you know, to reach out to those people that need to hear their story. So go ahead and donate. We need that, and they need your help.
Absolutely. Again, our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Like I said a moment ago on the previous program on Tuesday evening, we talked about the FBI raid on the IRP Solutions Corporation offices. And on Tuesday night, we had Kendra Hawden and Sharon Parks. They worked at IRP Solutions. Tonight in studio, we will have Amos Clark. He also worked at IRP Solutions. And he's going to give firsthand account from his perspective on what happened that day. Cliff Stewart, our very own Cliff Stewart, was there, and you heard him talk about that before, but he's going to shed a little bit more light on that. And then also, we had a very special guest on Tuesday evening, retired federal marshal, U.S. Marshal, Matthew Fogg, and he shared a lot of excellent information with us as to what really goes on, and he has a very interesting background himself, and so he's going to join us again. And we're going to have a little bit more time to talk with him. And so we look forward to that. As always, we ask you to keep our brothers in prayer as far as the IRP6. And as Ethel indicated, all the others out there who have been wrongly convicted. But for the IRP 6, we're talking about Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Kendrick Barnes. So we're happy to have you with us this evening, and we look forward to a very good show. Let's go to the news. So what do you have, Ethel or Cliff? Which one of you guys
got it? Go ahead, Ethel. Let's start with you. Ladies first.
Ladies first. Oh, all right then. Look at that, y'all. Okay. This one article that I was looking at, it came out of Simple Justice, and this was written by reporter. His last name is Greenfield. The title of it is Juries Matter Until They Don't. And what he's talking about in this article, there was a man here. His name was, Woodward, Mario Woodward. And he was on trial for murdering a police officer, Keith Houts. Okay, this took place in Alabama. Now, they had a jury there who actually was deciding, you know, this man's fate. They voted 8-4 not to kill him. And that didn't sit well with the judge, okay? So they said in Alabama, judges who are elected and must thus show their constituents how they are worthy of their votes, lest they find themselves forced to work for a living, they have the power to override the jury. So he came back and gave this man death, so saith the judge. And then after which he thanked the jury for their efforts and sent them on their way. Now, why do you have a jury? What is the purpose of having a jury if the judge is going to be the one that's going to make the decision in this case?
How does a judge see it comes back and he brings it out in this article. And before I make my comment, let me share with what he says. He says, and this is Justice Scalia, the judge, saying, second and more important, my observing over the past 12 years, the accelerating propensity of both state and federal legislators to adopt sentencing factors determined by judges that increase punishment beyond what is authorized by the jury's verdict, and my witnessing the belief of a near majority of my colleagues that this novel practice is perfectly okay, caused me to believe that our people's traditional belief in the right of trial by jury is in perilous decline. Mm-hmm. Basically, Judge Scalia is saying the right by trial by jury is going out the window, because if you have a jury that comes back and say, you know what, we looked at everything, yeah, you did wrong, mm-hmm. you committed a crime, mm-hmm. we find you guilty by the evidence that was presented to us, and we think you should do 5 years in prison. And the judge comes back and say, you know what, I don't like that for whatever reason. I could be a prejudiced judge. Mm-hmm. I could be a paid-off judge. I could be a judge that has just some personal problem with who you are, what you believe. And this judge comes back and say, no, the verdict is going to be death. So thanks, jury. We're going to let you all go. Thank mm-hmm. you for your service. But we're going to go ahead and kill this man. That right there. I mean, this judge needs to be beyond moved off the bench.
It's
this
messed
is ridiculous.
Up.
This is
It totally is. I don't get that. Wow.
Cliff, what do you got?
I got this thing about the ex-DA
mm-hmm.
taken into custody to begin his prison sentence. And this is in our favorite state,
mm-hmm.
state of Texas.
Oh, there we go.
And we have this Cameron County DA named Armando Villalobos.
Mm-hmm.
The Wolf Village is his last name, and he is a wolf. This man was caught on racketeering. He was convicted of favoritism, improper influence, personal self-enrichment, self-dealing, concealment, conflict of interest,
self-serving.
Everything. Oh yeah, that should have been the title.
It might be better if you tell us what he was not.
I'm telling you. I mean, this dude did everything. And, I mean, he was in office from 2006 through 2012, so like 6 years. He got convicted. He got immediately taken into custody. And they said that he also considered the office – this is the judge – considered the office of trust that Villalobos had held, noting that discretion cannot be for sale. It can't be dispensed to only those who have the right connections politically or the right lawyer. That sounds real good, Judge Haynen. I'm sure you meant really well when you made that statement. Mm-hmm. But we, as the citizens know that justice is for sale, that if you have the right connections, if you have the right amount of money, if you have a political position, that somebody will come to your rescue. Case in point, Eric Holder comes to the rescue of Senator Stevens, Ted Stevens, up in Alaska.
Yep,
you know,
yep.
God rest his soul, he died in a plane crash. But he was a senator, and Eric Holder stepped in and said, hey, let me look at this. Let me investigate this. We're trying to have Eric Holder to say, hey, as normal citizens, you have six men that have a transcript that's missing where a federal judge violated their Fifth Amendment right. Can they get some love?
Exactly.
Can you just do an investigation where is 200 pages, over 200 pages of missing transcript? But this is a case study in, you know, at least they got him.
Yes.
I mean, he got 13 years.
Yes.
And the judge also says the most important component of an effective and effective justice system, and this will make you cringe, is the public's ability to trust those who are responsible for enforcing the law.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
U.S. Attorney Robert Pittman said in a written statement, but even when there is a breach of that trust, as in this case, the public should take some comfort in knowing that there is a mechanism for detecting, rooting out, and punishing those who corrupt the process. At this point, I'm going to go ahead, ball this article up, and put it in the trash because that is a bunch of crap. It's like there is no mechanism that says that we're going to go after, we're going to root out, and we're going to punish the ones who do wrong. That sounds good for this situation, but we all know it's a lie. And it's too bad that it is. It's sad that it is because the American justice system does not work for the common citizen.
That's right.
That's
if it's
right.
something that they're saying, we're going to take this and put it, you know, we're gonna do a commercial or we're going to put this on the news to say we did something good. It's like when they make a drug bust. Oh, we found 100 kilos of cocaine. Well, what about the rest of it that came in that nobody else is talking about?
That's
the war on drugs is failing. The same way with this. You claim that there's some mechanism.
Yeah.
To root out and, you know, basically punish those who use the system on their behalf. But we all know personally that there's a judge and a prosecutor up in Denver, Colorado.
That's right.
That have done what they wanted to do, and no one will even investigate them.
Yeah. Now, let's move to this one. Here's one that was in the Christian Science Monitor, and it's under the heading of USA Update. And, you know, it's an article, it was on Tuesday, came out about Attorney General Eric Holder. And if we look at this and look at the content of this particular article and then some of the other things that we have talked about that the Attorney General has stated in public, man, if he executed on half the stuff that he talks about, it would be a wonderful system. So, you know, we're not going to, you know, we always say we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so here's one, again, where Attorney General Eric Holder is stepping up and he's saying where something is wrong. And so, and you know, we just need to, I don't know, folks out there listening, get behind Attorney General Eric Holder, I guess. You know, maybe if he gets some help from some folks, then things will happen. And then maybe he'll feel compelled to help folks like the IRP6 and help us out. Anyway, this article says that Eric Holder, on barring ex-felons from voting, he says that it's unfair and counterproductive. Now, he was speaking on Tuesday at a conference at Georgetown Law School. And Attorney General Eric Holder, he said that, you know, he's basically calling on states to repeal laws that bar ex-felons from voting after they've completed their sentences. And he's saying that this is unjust and counterproductive. Now, he's saying that he can't force states to withhold voting rights, but, you know, they really need to amend their laws. And when he says that whenever you tell citizens who paid their debts and rejoin their communities that they are not entitled to take part in the democratic process, we fall short of the bedrock purpose of equality, equal opportunity, and equal justice. And he says that has always served as the foundation of our legal system. Now, he also goes on and says that this dates back to the 1800s, where, and it really applies to African Americans, and it was part of the disenfranchisement, you know, keeping blacks from being able to vote.
Yeah.
He says, and actually in a sentencing project study, it says that there are about 5.8 million people nationwide who are barred from voting because of their past convictions. This is the kind of thing that mm-hmm. Attorney General Eric Holder is calling for, and it says that out of that 5.8 million, 2.2 are black.
2.2 million. Oh, wow.
And
God.
So, you know, he's raising a very critical issue here in stating that there is a problem that needs to be fixed. Like I said before, if he could execute mm-hmm. on half the stuff raising as issues, man, this would turn the system around.
What a wonderful world it would be.
Call me Attorney General Holder because I can help you out with that.
Hey, and you know what, Attorney General Eric Holder? We will endorse her statement. She will help you. Ms. Lopez will help you get anything done.
You. Do you hear me? I will help you.
This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We'll be right back in a moment.
Convicted six executives and held back evidence. Come on. Hundreds of pages of Mr. Manuscript. Right. Court circuit. 10th district denying the writ of mandibus. Read RP6. Critical rights violations. Scandalous. Their motivation to finish their business with major companies, the government, legal PD, DHS, potential customers. Come on. Fake potential. Obtain funds from banks and angel investors with no success. That calm mail down. Finance skeptics so they hire a staff and come to fill the gap with every attention to fulfill the contract. Money come back, everybody paid the bills, the wages, take care of all of that. No Friday, they got viable software, but you prepare them to those with nothing to offer. Prosecuted by the attorney's office, before the FBI gotta start investigating charges. Skipping steps, skipping the process, even barring the testimony of Andrew Alvarez. A witness, super care why any staffing company that could do with the rest. Credit check, would stick out the neck if there was no prospect they could collect. When they're reeling the net, it all relates to Harvey Silver's late statements about the vagueness of federal law, new district chaos, A_JustCause. Read at RP6.org, 347-205-9620, Just Blog. It's just us, but we don't gotta just talk. We can just walk through the courts for the cause with one voice and just free them all. Come on.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez and Cliff Stewart. Welcome to the program this evening. We're going to continue our conversation that we had on Tuesday talking about the raid on IRP Solutions and how it affected the folks who were there on that day. Later on in the program, we're going to bring on retired Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg. He's going to shed some light on what he understands as far as behind the scenes on what can happen on raids. Cliff, I guess we have someone on the phones that
We have a caller from area code 843. Caller, can you give us your name and your question or comment?
Yeah, this is Jim Irvin. I've been doing this federal criminal law for about 46 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've read lots about what you're talking about. The question is, in my mind, where is the most severe problem? Is it the missing 200 pages? Is it the bad lawyer? Is it the bad FBI? Is it the bad attorney general? Where is the seed of the problem that needs to be solved to exist for the folks?
Well, and thank you for your question. I think what we would say the seed of the problem, there are so many issues with this. I mean, all the way from start to finish, from the search warrant all the way up through the prosecution phase to the sentencing, the fact that you have over 200 pages of missing transcript. Now, we talked to attorney Mark Garagos. Most of you guys recognize his name. He's on the case. He said in his 31 years of practice, he has never seen any case like this where a judge is holding on to 200 pages of missing transcript. What you have to understand is that when a transcript basically is showing everything that happened during a case, if that transcript is missing, a defendant does not have a proper right to appeal because you can't see everything that happened during that case. The appellate court, they don't care about your opinion. They don't care about who you love or hate. They don't care about anything that you say that happened. They are going to go to that transcript mm-hmm. and say, this is the transcript. This is as it reads as what happened in court. Is there something that the judge did in there that is what they call reversible error? Okay. If there is, the case gets thrown out. And when we talk to the retired Attorney General of Utah,
Ohio. Yeah,
he told us, Mr. Petro told us that in his experience of over 20 years, that appellate court would act quickly in the case of this much transcript being missing and the meat of that transcript being in question. The question on the meat of this transcript is: did the judge violate the defendant's Fifth Amendment right? The defendant says, yes, you did. The judge says, no, I didn't. The appellate court says, we will go to the transcript to see what exactly happened. That transcript is not available. And Mr. Petro said, if that's the case, that appellate court should have acted on that in a matter of weeks, not 18 months.
Exactly.
Not the fact. I mean, these men have been locked up 18 months, and there's missing transcript. That is one of the issues. And there are several others. The judge should have recused herself. The expert witness wasn't allowed to testify. Exculpatory evidence wasn't allowed
yes.
to be presented. The Speedy Trial Act was violated. Mm-hmm. There's all kind of things on the table. But the one that people can understand the quickest and that seems the most blatant and outright ridiculous, and that it doesn't have to be explained. There's 200 pages of the missing transcript where the judge violates the Fifth Amendment right. That clean cut. Let these men out of prison until you figure out what's going on with that.
And, you know, Cliff, as I listened to the questions that Mr. Irving just gave,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was just thinking, yep, you can put a check mark next to that one. You can put a
exactly.
check mark next to that
truth,
one.
Exactly.
You just go down the list and put a check mark next to everything
exactly.
that Mr. Irving just asked. But like you just articulated, Cliff, you know, right now the most pressing issue is that 200 pages and
yeah.
all the circumstances that are around that. And so, you know, Mr. Irvin, we really appreciate the call and the question because it's a fair question.
Yeah, and if you really want to get the answer, call up Eric Holder's office.
Absolutely.
Say, hey, my name is Mr. Irving. I heard you got a case there in Colorado. There's 200 pages of missing transcript. You can reach him, 202-514-2003 or 2005. Call him up. Ask him about it.
That's
and
nice.
Let him answer the question for
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
And we'll see what happens from there. But we appreciate the call.
All right, so if we shift to the IRP 6 story and just give a little background on that and how the company started 2003 and marketing its flagship software, Case Investigative Lifecycle Software, acronym is SILC, C-I-L-C, And you know, folks may ask, those who are not familiar with the case, who are the IRP6? You know, we're talking about IT professionals. And like we said at the top program, you got Gary Walker, the CEO and chief architect of the software. David Banks was the COO. And also, you know, he was out there pushing the company and finding places that were suitable for the Silk software. Mm-hmm. Dave Zerpolo, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Kendrick Barnes. And, you know, the market, the prospects, the major prospects included the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, NYPD. And, you know, IRP Solutions did several demos for all of these agencies. Mm-hmm. Department of Homeland Security liked what they saw when IRP went to Washington, D.C. and said, put a federal face on it. So IRP went about doing that, and business didn't close as quickly as you thought it was going to. So the FBI raided the place, IRP corporate offices, in February of 2005. Ethel and I were just saying on Tuesday night, mm-hmm. actually, we're right at the nine-year anniversary
yes.
of that event.
Yep,
and that event changed lives and has been impacting lives for the last 9 years.
Yes.
Right now, and we haven't said it, I don't think, but the IRP6 are currently incarcerated. They have been incarcerated for 18 months waiting on the Court of Appeals to make a decision like you were just talking about, Cliff. And so, you know, we need something to happen in this case. You know, the company was accused of allegedly scamming staffing companies, and there is nothing farther from the truth. So as we get ready to get into the story, and we're going to come back here in a moment and play a clip of where the guys were talking about, where the guys, the IRP6, were talking about that day. Cliff, I showed you this. I read it on Tuesday night.
Mm-hmm.
This is phenomenal. It's put out by the agency Kirkland and Ellis. And it was done by two guys, part of that agency. It's the how-to guide for an effective FBI search warrant response program. And it was done by Tef W. Smith and John F. Hartman. Now, I just told you about the IRP story, and we're going to dive a little bit more into it, and we're going to hear, you know, Amos Clark's account of it. We're going to hear your account of it, Cliff. But I'm going to read this. It says, a team of 20 or more agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Department of Justice lawyers arrived suddenly, unannounced, at your company's executive offices in the United States at 8 a.m. Monday morning. The FBI agents produce a warrant to search the premises and to seize whatever evidence they find for use in an investigation into sketchily alleged criminal wrongdoing by your company and its employees. The agents start taking away your company's documents, search information, and other property from desk, files, computers, and other work and storage areas, including important confidential, even proprietary information about the company's day-to-day activities and long-term business strategies. Mm-hmm. Now, while the agents search and seize, they're also actively interviewing any company personnel they encounter, trying to pry out as much information as possible. Can they do this? This is one question that's there. And then what can you do? It goes on to say, do you think this could ever happen to your company or to any other company operating a respectable business in America? Think again. Like I wow. told you earlier, Cliff, when you read that,
yep.
this yes. is a company that has nothing to do with IRP, and when you read it, it's right out of the pages of the IRP story.
Sounds like February 9th, 2005.
Sounds just like it. And so when we come back after this break, we're going to dive right into that, and, you know, folks are going to be listening to you and Amos share a little bit of insight on what happened that day, and they're going to think that, you know, you're reading from what I just read, and it's the how-to guide for effective FBI search warrant response program. And so, you know, we're going to keep that handy because there's a lot of information in there that we'll be able to pull from time to time. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We'll be right back.
Dignity.
I stand for respect.
I stand for fairness.
when you turn out the light.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information without judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Joining us in the studio this evening is Mr. Amos Clark. And Mr. Clark was part of the IRP Solutions staff, and he's here this evening. He's going to share a little bit of insight from his perspective on what happened on February 9th, 2005. Mr. Clark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Glad for having me.
All right. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Before we do, let's play this clip from the IRP 6 as they share their insights and their thoughts of what happened on February 9th, 2005.
Well, on the morning of February 9th, 2005, the day of the FBI raid, I remember someone coming in my office saying the FBI was here. And I thought they were joking possibly, but I looked out the window and saw a lot of FBI agents, so immediately went to the front entrance, and just a feeling of shock.
Today, it really makes me angry. I mean, I remember being shocked the day it happened. I remember seeing FBI agents running into our building, chasing down people.
The events of that day are quite clear to me, and it really brings one to realize in this country, you're guilty until proven innocent.
Clearly, how we were basically waiting for our morning stand-up meeting we have every morning, and hear the commotion of all these agents coming to the door, and you know, basically being ordered around into the break room, without any explanation of what's going on or why these people were. Actually, I remember it took about a minute or two before they even identified themselves as the FBI.
And I think about it today, and it makes me mad, because here's something that we've done for them, and they're trying to accuse us of doing something wrong and illegal when we weren't doing anything wrong. We were doing something good. You don't see a lot of companies out there doing something good for the country, and here we are doing that, and they're trying to stop us from doing what's right and to be able to help them do their jobs better.
Okay, so those are some of the thoughts and that the IRP 6 were sharing with us as far as some of the things that was going on February 9th, 2005. So, Cliff, on February 9th, 2005, set it up for us. And Amos, if you can, you know, what happened on that day?
Well, like, when I got there, they were, the FBI, when I say they had already pretty much, you know, breached the door, and they were already inside. You know, I got a call on the way to work saying, hey, you know, the FBI is up at the building. There's all these FBI agents. They're walking around and all this and that. And, you know, just like everybody else, I'm thinking, well, if the FBI is there, yeah, there's some of the people we've been courting, talking to about the software. Maybe they're there to come see a demo.
Yeah,
but, you know, then it turns out they're up at the business, raiding the business, claiming that, you know, there's some wrongdoing going on. And I know, you know, Amos was the head of security. So, you know, he was there when they got there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've seen it on video. I saw how, you know, they were taunting the security guards and all these things. But he can talk to you about, you know, them coming in and basically breaching the facility.
So, Amos, so your role at IRP Solutions was what?
Right, I was security manager at that particular time.
And so on that morning, explain to us, you know, how you became aware of the FBI showing up at IRP Solutions and there to basically conduct the raid.
All right, Sam, on that particular morning of February of 2005, I was in the building conducting routine security purposes, and I had one security officer at the front entrance to the building, because every morning we would do searches on the people, check some of the their laptops and things that they were bringing in because of the security risk of, at the building and the information that IRP was building. Mm-hmm. So that particular morning, I was in my office, and I received a phone call from one of the security officers that there were some agents at the front desk, approximately about 8:50 that morning. And some of the employees was coming in at that time. So I went out front, and it was some agents there in suits as well as wearing blue jackets with the FBI on it. So we just assumed that they were coming to do business because IRP Solutions was doing business with law enforcement. So it wasn't a big thing. But upon approaching these agents, they were saying, they said, you know, I asked them about their business. State your business. You know, why are you here? Do you need someone? Who you here to see? Who you want to speak with? But the agents were, no, we're coming in. We need to get into the building. So we said, well, for what purpose? So there was a couple of agents. They were a little irate at the time. So we said, okay, look, we don't let anybody in the building without any business. So let us get in contact with the officers at IRP. And they immediately stated, do not touch the phones. Don't do anything. I need you guys just to step back and let us take over whatever. We need to get in the building. So at that time, me and one of the security officers say, we're not letting anybody in, you know. So they pull out a search warrant. We said, well, let us review the warrant and get in touch with the IRP people in the back. At that particular time, one of the employees were coming in and badged the door of the IRP solution. And at that time, the FBI agents, about 20 of them, just rushed us into the building.
Now, when you say, for folks who may not understand that type of lingo, when you say badged the door, what does that mean?
Right. I mean access into the building. First, you come to the reception desk, and then all employees have security badges. They have badges to get into the building. If you're not an employee, you don't have a badge to access the security.
So an electronic security card.
Exactly.
Kind of thing. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Right, thank
Go
you,
ahead.
Sam. And at that particular time, once the building was open and the employee badged the security system, the FBI just rushed in. They didn't care about – they grabbed that employee laptop and shoes, and they just got in and started screaming, everybody in here, you know, the FBI, get into the break room, started just going around so unprofessional because you know, I have a job to do as security manager.
Exactly.
And they were not respecting anything that we were saying. They
exactly.
just came in. And then later on, during that raid time, myself, when they were putting everyone into the break room area and stuff, mm-hmm. I did not go into the break room because the FBI was setting off alarms at the back door. And so I began to speak to some of the agents, and they didn't have a clue why they were there.
So some of the agents who were part of the raid team mm-hmm. expressed to you that they didn't even know why they were there.
No, they just know that the media here this morning, that they had some business to take care of, and they were informed. There were very few of the agents that knew what was going on, and then we turned them over to the executive, and everybody was just thrown off guard. But the way they came in, the disrespect, like it was drug dealers or something. It was a drug bust. You think, what's going on here? Here's the business who deal with law enforcement and all those things, and you're treating us like, you know, we had done something to break the law and no respect. So,
Amos, we've heard several times, from different parties, and, you know, when you read about the story and you hear different accounts, as far as this thing of all the employees being, you know, herded into the break room. You know, did they go around and see who was in the building and go from cube to cube, office to office? How did they do that?
Now, when they came in, they started bringing in equipment, you know, for something that they was looking for, not clear, not stating their business and stuff. So they were going around to every office and calling the people out. And I remember precisely, Dave Zapolo, one of the IRP 6, was there, and he's a Caucasian individual, and the rest is pretty much minority blacks. That he was not treated in the same manner.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, they allowed Dave to leave the building while everyone else was being ushered to the break room.
Wow.
I even seen Cliff is here tonight, and I noticed because I was free reign. Cliff, myself, it was probably the only two that just had free reign. We just decided, no, I need things to take care of and do. And I noticed them, you know, that they were treating Cliff, asking him about his wallet and looking at credit cards and different things, just totally out of the scope of what they had come there for. So it was just not a pleasant situation, and neither was they conducting themselves as you would think FBI agents would come. You think that it was some major raid. We were doing something just illegal. So
that's one of the things that also that I think I had heard somebody say that they were like slamming their handcuffs on the desk, you know, and frightening some of the women folk that were there and stuff like that. I don't
Right, they were representing themselves, showing that they had handcuffs, that they were carrying weapons, that, I mean, even at the security officers, as we were approaching them and telling them, okay, you can just speak to us like, you know, we understand, what are you here for?
Right.
They were just rude, like, hey, you guys get in there. They were walking through the building, observing the building, like, wow, you know, what these guys are doing in this business. But it was just a day that you just would like to forget, because there was no respect in the way they came into the building.
Right.
So the reports were correct, how the people said they were treated.
Right.
Because afterwards, about 30 minutes, 35 minutes later, I went into the break room. I was asked to go into the break room with them, and some officers were standing at the door if you need to go to the restroom or those type things. But there were still a few was in there just confused themselves of why they were here.
Right.
And why, you know, you're treating these people like this, because this is just a business, and you're coming in. You say you was coming in for financial records,
mm-hmm.
but wow, it was just a mess. So Cliff
can
share.
And you know, the thing that really got to you, because with me being on the technical side, I was doing software development. I also was doing system administration and IT services. We all wore a lot of different hats
mm-hmm.
to get the business done. And so when they take me in the break room, they're like, you either log on to the servers or we're going to crash them all. We're going to destroy the data. We need to get into these servers. And when I asked they had a group of IT FBI agents that were there, and I asked them, why do you need to get into these servers? You claim that you're looking for financial records. This is the development server. This is the test server. This is our DNS server. This is our WIN server. Why do you need to get in? And they told us, I don't know. All I know is Agent Smith told me to copy everything on every machine in the building. And I'm like, why? And all they can say, you know, and this is why while Agent Smith isn't there, is I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Wow. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. And we're talking about the IRP Solutions Corporation raid that occurred in February of 2005. We're at the anniversary of that, actually. And so Mr. Amos Clark is here. He was in the facility on that day. He was part of IRP Solutions. Cliff is sharing his ideas on that day. Our number is 347-838-8976. We'll be right back. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. This evening, we are talking about the raid that occurred on IRP Solutions back in February 2005. And as you know, the listeners who follow the story, those who may not be familiar with the story, the IRP 6 are currently incarcerated in federal prison, have been incarcerated for over 18 months now. And the IRP 6 are Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Kendrick Barnes. Their case is currently under appeal. One of the major issues with the appeal is over 200 pages of transcript that's missing. So if you want to find out a little bit more information about the story, follow the story as we talk about it, go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. And as usual, you can always go to ajcradio.com and check out our programming schedule and follow us each week as we talk about it. Our number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Joining us in the studio is Amos Clark. He was with IRP Solutions. He was the head of security at IRP Solutions at the time. Cliff Stewart, our very own Cliff Stewart, was also in the building on that day that the raid occurred. And just before the break, Cliff, you were sharing some information as far as the FBI going after the servers, the development server, the test server, the mail server, everything, as far as copying all kinds of stuff. Yet the warrant said they were there for financial records.
The warrant says financial records. They're in the server room, and they're going after everything. And another thing that kind of shocked me, because, you know, these are the technical guys that are working at the FBI, and Kendrick Barnes, one of the IRP 6, because his title is CIO, So he and I are there in the server room. We're trying to get them to explain to us why it is they need to go into the servers. And as we're, you know, they're asking, well, what's this server for? What's that server for? They're not even understanding what we're telling them. And so then we really start to get, you know, not only leery about the fact that they're there, but then thinking, if you guys start messing with stuff, you're really going to tear some stuff up. Because, I mean, they didn't know, and probably nobody here knows, you know, what a WAN server is. They didn't know what the DHCP server was. They didn't know the technical terminology that it took to run a server room. And so Ken and I are like, you know, if we let them in here, are they going to tear some stuff up? If we don't let them in here, they already told us they're going to tear some stuff up. So, you know, we're kind of between a rock and a hard place. Like, what are we doing? That's why we started asking them, why do you need to get into this particular server? And like I mentioned before the break, you know, the guy, he starts telling us, well, Agent Smith told us to. We don't know why we need to copy all this. This is not what we normally do, copying every computer in the whole building. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, another point that I wanted to bring up, you know, from a security perspective, and want Amos to talk about this, a lot of times, you know, as part of the indictment, they were saying, well, the IRP executives weren't letting, you know, the representatives from the staffing company, you know, they would come up to the building and they would refuse to see them. You know, they wouldn't talk to them, this and that. And from a security perspective, you have to understand the clients or potential clients that we're dealing with. You're talking about Department of Homeland Security. You're talking about Department of Justice. All these places that they have to know that we as a company have a secure environment. If we're going to be dealing with their with their data, if we're going to be dealing with their forms, I mean, some of the forms, you know, that DHS has sent us, Sam said, for IRP solutions eyes only. So
yep,
we have to ensure that we keep those type of data, you know, under lock
secure.
And key. And so so they're saying, well, they wouldn't let people in.
Mm-hmm.
The rule was you do not come into the building, you do not get past the security door unless you have a reason to be there. And just like Amos was saying with the FBI when they came in, you're not just coming in just because you say you want to come in and talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
This is a secure facility. You have to have reason. And without an appointment, you're not coming into the building. And, you know, it is atrocious that they would think if they went to Verizon, if they went to CenturyLink, if they went to, you know, any of these corporate headquarters that have a security desk, that have security doors, that's the only way you get in. You know, you badge in with a security badge. That's how you get access. Just to think we're just going to let you in just because you say so.
And, you know, Cliff, having worked in for federal contractors previously, you know, people do not just walk up to a building of a company that has contracts with the federal government
That's
and
right.
expect to walk in. I mean, your family doesn't even get to come in. They have something called Family Day.
Right.
And if you have, you know, that's the only time your family even gets in. And that's one time a year.
And they have to have a badge.
Exactly. And everything is on lockdown. There's nothing exposed. Every demo that's shown is sanitized, so to speak. It's like anything classified is stripped out of it. So, you know, they show you the bells and whistles and the fireworks and all that kind of stuff about what you're doing, but you don't just walk up in there. And so, you know, Amos, when you said that an employee walked up and badged in, and because of the fact that you guys as security, you were checking bags and purses and briefcases and so forth, to be sure that there was no contraband, so to speak, being taken in. But more importantly, when people are going out, that they aren't taking classified information or proprietary information with them. So, you know, IRP had regular security protocol in
place.
And so, Amos, I mean, are we off base on that?
No, right on, because IRP had strict security requirements for entering or exiting the building. And we would perform those duties very well. As you know, the people that was coming to IRP, if you had an appointment or visitors, we would have you sign the visitors log sheet, and then we would call the personnel who you wanted to visit with, and we would escort you into the building, and we would make sure that you wasn't bringing in anything that would jeopardize the software that IRP was
developing.
Developing.
Yeah.
So it's standard protocol. Yeah, so when the FBI came, it was no different. We was going to inquire from them their business, state their business of why they were there, and to let them in the building, but they did not do that.
And you know what's strange, Cliff, is that, you know, that piece I read earlier from Kirkland and Ellis,
mm-hmm.
there is a section in here that talks about, well, this is the how-to guide for effective FBI search warrant response program. There is a section in here that talks about how do you respond if the FBI shows up with the search warrant and wants to get into your building. All the things, and now, Amos, have you read this before?
No, I haven't seen that.
All the things that Amos just stated
mm-hmm.
are in this guide. I read it earlier. Mm-hmm. And there's a section in here that says you need to have a response team, and that, you know, if they show up, your security team does the appropriate things as far as contacting the executives of the company, letting them know, hey, we have guests, you know, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that response team is already predetermined. They already, you know how to handle the situation. They take the warrant, review the warrant, and like you said, you guys tried to be respectful to the FBI agents. This guide says be respectful to the agents and let them know, hey, yeah, we're going to help you out. But then you also bring in your legal folks, which my understanding is that legal for IRP showed up.
Mm-hmm.
But when the FBI didn't want to play according to the rules, and like, you know, we talked about you guys as far as your security or IRP security, checking briefcases to be sure people aren't taking proprietary type stuff out. But when the FBI searched people who were going out, and Ms. Parks and Ms. Houghton shared their stories,
right,
it was a totally different situation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And I know we only got a couple minutes till the break. Our engineers are going to get us if we go past that. But I want to, Amos, you know, give us a little background about, you know, your security background. I know that you worked at the Air Force Academy here in the Springs, but give us some background so that the listeners can understand that it's not just, these are not just the security protocol for IRP solutions. I mean, Sam talked about the different federal agency or contractors that he's worked for, but give us some of your background so the listeners can understand where you're coming from and, you know, how you've been trained to deal with this situation.
All right, thank you, Cliff. My background is I'm an ex-military personnel, so I've worked on several ex-military contracts as well as private security. I've been in the private security sector for over 10 years, working for a corporation for the local library districts and for the security at the Air Force Academy contractors for all those initiatives. So I understand that the security procedures and how you ought to go about securing our facilities as well as the grounds for an organization. So I have years of experience and training. You don't just put someone in these positions and expect them. There are protocols you need to go by, and you do lots of training, months and years of training, and how to go about that. So securing the IRP building was something that we had prior training, had brought on a fellow security officer that had worked with me for many years, and we were skillfully trained and professional if the FBI would show up, if anyone would show up. Because the FBI doesn't mean it's the FBI. It could be someone in disguise. So we was trained, and if there was not the right person and didn't have the credentials, then we was not going to let them in. I mean, if you ever visit Hewlett Packard or all those places, I was a lead security officer at the HP contract before I went over to IRP Solutions. So you have to know that there's strict guidelines and rules you must follow, but also each company can set up something for themselves. So we'll get back with you for more information.
Yeah, awesome. So this is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We're sharing a little bit more information about February 9th, 2005, when IRP Solutions was raided by the FBI, resulting in the wrongful conviction and now wrongful incarceration of the IRP 6. Joining us on the other side of the break is Matthew Fogg, a retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal. He was on with us Tuesday evening. Excellent, excellent segment. We're looking forward to that when we come back from the break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We've been talking about the raid on IRP Solutions that happened in February of 2005. And now, I think, Cliff, do we have Matthew on the phone?
Yes.
Okay, so joining us is Mr. Matthew Fogg, a retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal. Mr. Fogg was with us on Tuesday evening, shared a lot of valuable information, and so he agreed to join us again this evening. Welcome to the program, Mr. Fogg.
Hey, good to be on your show.
Awesome. Hey, so for the listeners who did not tune in on or who were not tuned in on Tuesday evening, if you would, please share a little bit of information about your background, and then you can, you know, kind of start, we'll start diving into some background information on some of the things that can go wrong, you know, during a raid. But first, let's start with your background.
Right. Well, I'm a Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal. I retired as a chief. I had to fight to get that recognition. I'm also a civil rights advocate. I'm from Washington, D.C., ended up going to college in West Virginia and then and graduating and then becoming a U.S. Marshal. Spent my career in the Marshal Service and pretty much worked drug and gun addiction, task forces, worked witness protection program, did an airlift and the transportation of prisoners, involved in the SWAT team operations with Rodney King riot, we took a SWAT team out there, Cuban flotilla, just a merit of various federal law enforcement operations all over the country, dragnets, everything, and as well as, again, having then turn around and fight the same institution for racism, discrimination on the inside, and trying to get it cleaned up, man, and ended up winning a major federal court case in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C., Matthew Fogg versus the U.S. Department of Justice, and ended up winning and then had to continue fighting is where I am today, class agent in a class action. Just always, man, it's a never-ending battle when you talk about race relations in America and what happens to people of color, no matter what situation. I say, you know, you put that formula of race in the situation, I don't care what it is, whether it's the president of the United States or whether it's a street sweeper, you end up dealing with issues outside of what normal law does. So that gives you a quick brief synopsis. Also, I was a first responder at Ground Zero when World Trade. I was in New York when the buildings dropped, and I responded and ended up, my picture ended up in People's Magazine. We were bringing the body of a dead firefighter down off the hill, smoke, fire, everything. Man, I was right in the middle of it as a first responder.
We, that's very, this is Cliff Stewart. I wasn't here on Tuesday night with you guys, but Mr. Fogg, we appreciate you coming back to deal with some of these issues. That is a very impressive resume, and I want to first off say, you know, thank you for all of your service because a lot of times, you know, you guys don't get the respect that you deserve. You don't get the, I don't want to say accolades, but for lack of a better word, that you guys really deserve because you put your life on the line a lot. All the time, constantly. Like you say, you're there at Ground Zero, you're doing witness protection, prisoner transport, and, you know, we understand there are some bad prisoners out there, and you guys put yourself in harm's way. We appreciate that. And but, you know, talking to Sam and Ethel and the rest of the crew that was here Tuesday, they were telling me about, you know, the things that you have seen on the inside. You mentioned about your fight for equality on all hands, basically everywhere you've been, and, you know, talk to us a little bit about, you know, kind of the inside on how the FBI does things that from your perspective you would say this is just outside of the realms, outside of their reach. They're going far, you know, I would say above and beyond, but let's say below and beneath what they should be doing as a
well, you know, Well, you know, I tell you, I was listening to you you guys talking a little bit about security and how they came in. Let me first say this. I didn't work for the FBI. I worked for the U.S. Marshals, but we all fall right under the purview of the U.S. Department of Justice. So that's our mother agency. So, and we all have the same protocol when it comes down to rule, you know, think about federal law and the things that federal law requires of us to operate. We go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. FBI had their training center. But all of the rules, procedures, and how we are to operate, you know, it's common practice throughout all federal law enforcement. So when it comes down to executing search warrants, which I've done many of those, and you know, seizing information, we, you know, the Marshal Service has an asset forfeiture seizure program. So we get all of that training, what to do, how to go about it, protocols. Now, I was kind of listening, but what people have to understand, I was listening to you guys talk about your internal protocols, how you operate your, how you, you know, you secure your proprietary information and everything that you have in your operation. But you got to understand, once a criminal indictment or a criminal search warrant is issued, there are, you know, pretty much the discretion for law enforcement people searching for information, it's wide. It's almost like no ending to it, especially when you're talking about small items. One thing, you're going in looking for drugs. It's another thing, you got to go into computers or you're going to look for information or documents. Now, man, you can go through all kinds of documents. You can go through records and you can do all of that. And when I was listening to you guys say, well, you know, they have certain we have certain internal protocols where, you know, we don't let people do this and we don't let them in and do that. Man, it's almost like I wanted to say what somebody was saying. Well, what do you do when the FBI gets on the scene or the marshals or whatever? It's almost like, I mean, not to be facetious, but it's almost like you just place your head firmly between your legs, you know, and you kiss your behind. Because, I mean, it's almost like at that stage, when they come in, when we come in, we've got the full brunt of the U.S. government behind us. So even if we go in there and we make mistakes, or if we even do stuff that we know isn't correct, we're going to always articulate it as if though, well, it was a mistake, or I didn't know, or, you know, whatever. And we get under the color of law, we're going to protect it for the most part. Now, of course, attorneys get attorneys. And each side's got to get their attorneys, and how they wind up most of the time getting away with a lot of stuff because most entities don't have the power to fight back. You guys, you were Verizon or somebody like that, some big organization, yeah. You know, you could have done a whole lot of things, but IPR6, from what I understand, and the computer program, what you guys were doing, you were on the ground floor, you had no real money. No way. Anytime somebody says to me that they had to get court-appointed attorneys, FBI knew that before they went in there. Justice Department knew that before they raided that place. So they already kind of, you know, we do a brainstorming session. We kind of know automatically what resources the suspects have and how they're going to be able to determine how they're going to be able to fight back. They kind of know that in advance. And so,
hey,
you know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say. Yeah, this is Ethel. I know. I was just going to say. So they're already crooks. They're already lying. They're already conniving and everything else when they even go and get a warrant. So why even get a warrant? You know, if they know that,
well,
that's what they're going to do.
No,
and it's going to.
Well, listen. You gotta play by the rules. But you're the one who set the boundaries. In other words, you got to at least say you went and got the warrant. You got to do certain things according to protocol. But after that, you just run amok. I mean, I'm saying to you, anybody that has been around our government and been around how things are done, law enforcement people can go awry, okay?
Yeah.
And U.S. attorneys and district attorneys can go awry and withhold evidence and There are so many people sitting in jail now because of that.
Exactly. And, you know, the reason that I say that is if you start out with getting this warrant based on a lie and based on false pretenses, you know, as to why you are going to, you know, to search and
right.
raid this Then the people that they're going to search, you know, something, you know, they have no other options left.
That's right.
You know, they have to say something, you know, because
well,
if you're coming to check financial records and you don't do that, that's not even. I mean, the financial records are left in the middle of the floor. You don't even touch them.
So you know something? Let me tell you something. I haven't been on many raids, and what I'm saying to you is, we looking for something. We don't have to tell you what we're looking for. They don't have to tell you nothing. They can just tell you stand in a corner. I mean, that's all of the protocol. You ever go look at, you know, go through the courtroom, go sit down and talk to a U.S. attorney or somebody who will give it to you straight. They'll tell you in a raid, all that officer, when he comes in and says, we have a warrant for this premises and we're looking for certain documents, get out of the way or we're gonna restrain you, put you in a corner. We're going to look for certain things and we're going to ask you questions. Now, you can say to them when they ask you questions, I'm not telling you nothing. That's your prerogative. Or, like the guy said, he kind of threatened them saying, well, if you don't tell us, we're going to blow up your machines. Well, I got, you know, if I'm running a business like that, hopefully I got a copy of what I got there because, you know, I would say, you know, I might get water damage could blow up my machine or a hurricane come and blow up my machine. So I'm just saying you, but when they said that, at that point I'd be saying, well, I'm not saying nothing to you until I talk to my attorney. Now, you have a right to do that. But other than that, they can run a mark on your place, and they can be carrying boxes of stuff out. We see it every day on the news where FBI and raid a place, and they're carrying out boxes of stuff. You think them people sitting there say, oh, you can have this and you can leave that? No.
Mm-hmm.
It was we just take stuff and wash it through it, and, hell, we might find, we find all kinds of stuff on you. I mean, I don't know if you guys ever heard of COINTELPRO, but you know, I'm sorry.
And no, Matthew, because we gotta go to a break real quick. But before we go to that break, I just wanted to bring up, and we'll discuss it when we come back. We went, sat down with the chief counsel for the FBI up in Denver. His name Bob Goffey. We sat down with him and talked to him about the way that this search warrant and raid happened. And he explained to us some things that, and I understand where you're coming from, but he explained to us some things that says if they went outside the realms of what the search warrant is, and I understand it's just a document, it's for show and tell, but we're going to get into that, into what the chief counsel said when we come back from this break.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number, 347-838-8976. Joining us this evening, Matthew Fogg, retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Ask one more. You might just save a life.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening, Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, retired. And Matthew, again, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time out of another evening to share some information with us. And you know, you're sharing a lot of good information. So, Cliff, you were talking about something during the break that you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, Matthew. Like I said, we went up to Denver. And talked to you know, the chief counsel, Bob Goffey, at that time, and talked to him about the raid, how it went, how the search warrant was laid out, what they had in the search warrant, and how they conducted the raid. And what he told us was, well, first off, if they conducted that raid and collected anything that was outside what was laid out in the search warrant, that in itself was illegal, and that would make the entire search warrant illegal. He also said that if they did do that, that that would open up the FBI to be sued. And Matthew, I don't know if you got us on in the background because we're hearing some feedback. Okay, there we go.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to see.
No problem. But yeah, so Chief Counsel Goffey, he told us if they went outside the realms of that raid, they collected anything, it makes the whole search warrant illegal. Then at that point, if you execute an illegal search warrant, the FBI is up to be sued. And so, and like I said, you know, I totally get how you say, you know, hey, the U.S. Marshals, the FBI, you know, DA, they can come in and say, hey, we're here for this. Either you get us out of our way, or we'll move you out of our way. But that has to be, there has to be, and I'm just making this as a general citizen, and I'll let you respond basically from your position and your experience. But there has to be a protocol difference between what would be considered, okay, we're going after a drug cartel, and we're going after a corporate entity. There has to be, because say you go in a corporation and you got you just got a bunch of people who are on the phones doing customer service. You can't go in there with the same show of force saying, hey, move out of our way, we're coming to get this, coming to get that, this and that. You know,
let me tell you what they can do.
Uh huh.
I mean, because I'm listening to you, but let me just tell you what they can do. See, when they go in, when we go in, well, I'll just say whatever they did with that. I wasn't there. But when we go in, we expect for people to be very, very upset, complaining, what are you doing? They ask a million questions. But the name of the game is we're not here to answer questions. We're not here to answer questions. We're here to ask questions. I mean, that's kind of our training. So, of course you would be baffled. And then we say we have a search warrant for these premises. Okay, we don't have to tell you what we're specifically looking for. We don't have to. That's what I'm trying to do. That's what makes it so difficult. On top of that, they know when they go in there, like I said, they're looking for some small item. They can go through a whole bunch of it, and especially if it's a document or if it's something that they're not sure of exactly. That when that warrant is written up, those attorneys up there, the U.S. attorneys often, they get together and they put down, they know what they want to get, okay? So they make that thing as broad as possible to say, I'm looking for something, but I'm not really telling you, but the way I got that warrant written up, I can grab everything, including the toilet paper, okay? Now, would you got to find out later through discovery and everything what it was that they, what were they looking for, what they asked for. By that time, you know, everything gets changed because they didn't came in and got what they wanted. Now, mm-hmm. If it comes down to something that they took that maybe they shouldn't have taken, that's going to be a legal battle. It's going to take time. It's going to be, okay, well, maybe you shouldn't have grabbed this. You got to give them that back. You know, that type of thing. By that time, your life has already been turned topsy-turvy. These guys have been, obviously, they were indicted. So when you get an indictment, they got to take that thing, and they go before a grand jury. You're not even there to even defend yourself. They're in there. I didn't sit in on grand juries as far as with how the government does this, and I didn't work with grand juries here in D.C. and Washington D.C. and see how those people are all in the room. And the U.S. attorney, they run that show now. There's not supposed to be a situation where I become really chummy with the assistant U.S. attorney if I'm on the grand jury. But let me tell you, man, and them grand juries, man, they get a relationship with those people. They know who they are. They speak every morning. Everybody comes in. They set the U.S. attorneys and them, they set the pace on where these people want to be at. And in other words, it becomes this sort of relationship with these people. So when they bring in documents to say they want to indict a case or paper a case, and they get, mm-hmm. and they come and they explain all of the reasons why IPR6 did what they did. And that's the system, the United States attorney sitting there telling their side of the story with all of their information. Them people sitting in that room, they're going on what's being told. And now they'll take a vote, but a lot of them sit there and say, man, you know what, from what they told us, it looks like these people are doing something wrong here. And I'm making it very, you know, elementary, but my point I'm making is, once they're told that and they issue that warrant, they say, okay, yes, we believe these people did the things that you said they did. There's enough information here to indict or, you know, bring forth a charge. Once they do that, man, that one, and then they go to that judge. That judge, most of the time, those judges, everybody knows the game. So when that U.S. attorney goes to that judge, they all know each other. They put that thing in place, and before you know it, they knock it on your door. And they don't have to even knock, to be honest. I mean, they knock, yeah, they knock, but I'm saying, if you say, well, we want to see some ideas, man, they can battle ram your door. They can just go right on it. I'm not here to get you for you to invite me in. I'm here to tell you I'm coming in. Now, let's make this, you can open the door and step aside, or you can sit here and you can try to resist a little bit, and then I can battle ram the door and maybe throw a charge of, you know, interfering with you. Something crazy that you got to wind up fighting. It's a lot of discretion, man. I mean, I'm sad that I got to say that, in the sense that once you take all that discretion and then you throw racial disparities, homophobia in the equation, man, you have a monster on your hands. I mean, you really do, and you can't. It's almost like, what do we do? That's why we say, yes, there are a lot of people that are innocently convicted because they don't have the money to get an attorney that maybe could. And then you got a lot of places where attorneys don't even want to get involved because they don't want their taxes looked at, or they don't want their stuff being scrutinized if they put up a real good fight. It's a whole, the sad to say, man, it's a web of stuff that takes place. That ends up having, and I'm not saying this to make anybody disenchanted, but what I'm saying is it is a fight that requires us to say, first thing, number one, is we constantly have to have oversight upon oversight on a system that has already been designed in place to say that black folks, it started off by saying black people were not really human beings. That system started like that. So therefore, today, man, we look and we see the numbers of African Americans that are in the criminal justice system, it's no doubt in anybody who has any type of brain on their head, even white folks, anybody, they look at that and they say, something is really, really wrong with that system.
Yeah.
But then they go on with their business, huh?
Matthew, when we come back on the other side of the break, let's talk a little bit more about that and how race relations impact the law enforcement community. And some of the things that you can share with us, and then how that actually affects and impacts, when a raid is going down, and how different neighborhoods are targeted, and how some are not necessarily targeted, but they just kind of ignore them. So when we let's talk about that. Had a little technical glitch there. Joining us this evening, retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg. Our number this evening is 347-838-8976. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. Just Cause Coast to Coast, education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, Cliff Stewart, Ethel Lopez. Joining us in the studio, Mr. Amos Clark. He was an employee at IRP Solutions, and he shared some nice thoughts with us earlier in the program, and he's hanging around with us a little bit. On the phone, we have retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg. He was on the program with us on Tuesday evening. And Mr. Fogg is sharing some information as to, you know, what goes on behind the scenes and the thought processes when federal agents raid a business. So, Mr. Fogg, I got a question for you. The IRP Solutions, the IRP 6 was basically an African-American company.
Right.
And the principals of the company, all African-American. I think we talked a little bit about this on Tuesday evening. The entire raid team on February 9th, 2005, were all, I'll say, non-African-American. They were, I think, for the most part, all Caucasian.
Yes, they were.
Right.
And then also, the FBI SAC, the special agent in charge in the Denver area for the state of Colorado, was African-American, and he didn't even know anything about this raid. Now, on Tuesday evening, you shared some information with us as far as, you know, some of the things that go into you know, when they're deciding on targeting someone. And for the most part, you were talking about drug-related raids, and then you talked about, you know, how you raised questions on those kind of things. So that's one question. Another thing I want you to talk about as well is the fact that how you said, you know, earlier you shared with some of the typical things that go on, but then you also, on Tuesday, you talked about, you know, when you were in charge of task force, that you, you know, you took a different approach because of the fact that you saw and understood the underlying agenda a lot of times of what was going on. So if you could tackle a couple of those things.
Okay, well, two things. Once you get in this field, you become part of a network, a good old boy network in a lot of ways. It's an operation that you have to depend on. It's a command and control environment, and you have to depend on your colleagues to back you up. It's like a football team in a game if you want to win the game. So a lot of times what happens is a lot of good officers, and I say most officers are good, but that doesn't really matter because I don't hide behind that because I said all you need is a couple of bad ones and they spoil a lot. But the bottom line is people can always hide behind, well, I wouldn't do that, but if I don't say anything when I see you doing it, I'm just as complicit. But the bottom line, the problem is in this line of work is we're all on from the police officers on the street to the district attorneys to the DA to the judges. We're all in that family of that whole what we call the justice institution. And so everybody gets to know everybody. So a lot of times favors, you know, things that you might can get away with that normally you couldn't get away with. It's a lot of processes that takes place. And when you see an indictment that goes down, a warrant that's issued, and how are they going to do the search? And there's discussions about this stuff. And when I used to be a part of it, speaking on the issue about just, you know, talking about the drug and gun and addiction task force and how we were setting this stuff up, man, and how we were going to go in and do our raids and all of that, man, there would be briefings on briefings on this stuff. And a lot of times, in law enforcement, as I mentioned to you guys last night, well, we know law enforcement is probably, we call it one of the last plantations. Now, when you do get African-Americans that work their way up that rank and get to chief deputy and get to special agent in charge and SAC status and all of that, those folks have seen everything. It's like even in the military, when you get a guy that reaches to the level of 4- and 5-star generals and all that, these guys have seen it all. And a lot of stuff they've had to turn their head on because it's like they told me, Frog, you can't police everything, and the Justice Department is too big with too many resources. If you take on these people with your complaints, they'll either kill you or they'll discredit you or they'll snuff you out or they'll put you in prison. And these are things that were told to me by my colleagues and other people. Man, you're going against really what we call a stronghold. And the bottom line is when I made the decision, like when we were doing our drug and gun addiction task force, when I thought was they would set these operations up and we pick like say 7 cities around the country and we do these 90-day dragnets where we go in and you know, pretty much marry up with the local and the state police. Like we come into Denver, Denver would be one of our cities. We'd hook up with all of the Denver police, state police, and we U.S. Marshal, and we deputize those guys so they could ride with us, and we'd go across state lines, and then we just go after all of the warrants that are out there and any cases that are being worked on. And even if it happened to at the time, the IPR6, if they had been in existence at the time, we would have had that dragnet. We would have raided your place probably too. But the bottom line is, during those operations, I begin to see that most of the targeted areas a lot of times was urban areas. So one of the reasons that, you know, that the special agents in charge and people at the top are telling us, the reason they don't go into the more affluent areas, the white areas, and the more affluent, even though they have more drugs, they got the purer stuff, they got more than anybody got on the street. But the reason why we weren't really trying to hit those areas because we knew that the resistance we would get, we go out there and start locking in people. If they got money to get attorneys, to get the system, they know somebody in the system, it's a process. So it's race and let's just go to the weakest link. So what you begin to see was ethnic cleansing and racial profiling, even though you had a lot of white officers and agents that didn't understand that that's what was happening. They just thought, like, hey, we're just going to get folks. We're going to do our job. If they're breaking the law, we're going out. I said, yeah, but this is not an equal opportunity enforcement operation, because if we really went after everybody that was really selling drugs and using that stuff the way we could have, they would have ended the war on drugs. They would have treated it like alcohol. They would have said, okay, let's regulate this stuff and then let's go in the direction of treatment. So when you're dealing with that type of background, then myself, once I decided to speak out, and I started speaking out on the other improprieties and stuff, the civil rights violations and the things that I saw, they begin to slowly turn the guns on me. So I had family and everybody begging me to just, you know, go along, because people loved me, man. They felt like, you said, Fog, you're articulate. We like working for you. I had all of the qualities, man, that they liked in a law enforcement officer. The problem was, I wasn't going to sit back and watch the goes on. And so you got a lot of people, and then when you talk, that's why I said when you throw race in the problem game, you got a lot of white Americans that don't want to believe race is still a problem in this country. They don't want to really, you get out into some of these, man, they don't want to hear that. I mean, these are the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren are the people that get all kinds of holocaustic stuff to Black Americans during the slave era. So these people, they don't want to believe that. They don't want to understand and realize that America is still a very divided system. That's fact y'all went up and spoke to, who said, oh, well, I didn't even know about it. I don't know if you could go on, he really didn't know about it. And then on top of that, women should then say to you, well, if they did that and if they did that, sure, he's going to give you the textbook protocol way things should be done. But the reality of it is, the IPR 6 went to jail. They got convicted. Stuff was withheld. Information was left out. The judges, everybody works together in this field, man. And I tell people that. And once somebody really does understand that, that's enough to scare you away, man. We used to bring them guys in, man, and say, look, now, they tell them, man, if you don't tell us what we need to know, we got enough stuff on you to jam you up. You bring, man, let me tell you something, bro. Man, we used to go to people's places, man. You start throwing them Benjamin Franklins on the table that we have, you know, informant money and so forth. And you got guys telling you, man, I ain't seen nothing. I don't know anything. I don't know nothing. You start throwing them Benjamin Franklins on the table. Next thing you know, you hear them say, are y'all going to hurt them? No, man, we're not going to hurt them. You throw a couple more on the table, they'll say, grandma's hiding in the closet. I mean, is that type of culture, man.
And see,
I mean,
Matthew,
listening
to what you say is like you realize, just like you say, it's a culture, but these are things that we got to fight against. I mean, we can't say,
yeah,
okay, you know, we scared, or, you know, they gonna get you, they gonna come after your family and stuff like that. Those are the type of things, and you know, I ask a question. I'm not that old. I'm 42, and I've asked a question for
right,
like 25, 30 years. Who picked up the mantle when Martin Luther King fell?
Me.
And I'm saying, I'm like, Ethel Lopez said she picked it up. I agree with her. But I'm like, where is our civil rights leaders that's saying what you're saying? They're saying, okay,
right,
I'm seeing this segregation on a different level. But nobody's really doing nothing about it. Nobody,
right.
Nobody saying, all they're saying is, well, you could die. They could do this. They could do that. But we got to fight against it, because if enough people fight against it, then it's like, okay, you're not going to stand against all of us, and all of us, I'm you know, the American citizen.
Right. Right.
That's what we have to do to get laws changed, to get things to say, you know, prosecutors got to be held accountable.
Right.
Judges got to be held accountable. If the FBI,
right,
if you as a chief deputy U.S. Marshal, if you do something outside the realms of what the law is that you're allowed to do, you should be held accountable for that. It should be across the board. They call criminal drug dealers criminals, gun runners criminals, dog killers criminals. what about the judge who says instead of putting this man in prison, like the jury say, this judge say I don't like him, I'm gonna give him the death penalty. What about the prosecutor
who said? And let me tell you another thing.
Uh-huh.
Just, not to interrupt you, but just even what you said about the judges. Now, judges get a certain amount of immunity. Okay, they can get away with just about, and the system has made it that way. Judges,
yeah.
they can issue a warrant or whatever. They're not under the same scrutiny that even other agents are under. So that's why you got to take it to a judge. Now, you got a judge out there that's crooked, or a judge out there that really doesn't. It could care less about race relations and could care less about how many blacks are being brought through the system, then they're just going to issue the warrant. So it's what I'm saying, and you're right about what are we doing? How do we fight it? Now, I can just tell you here and now, if you think about slavery lasted for several hundred years. I don't mean decades. We don't mean, one century, but we talk about several centuries. Now, and then even after it was over with, we still continue to this day to deal with the remnants of slavery. That's because when they made examples out of people, you know, man, look, let me tell you something. When you go to jail, you talk to them guys that's in jail. I mean, this has rocked their world, okay? You ain't got to tell me. I know people in prison. It rocks your world. And you get to a point where, man, you wonder if you're going or coming. So what I'm seeing you is, you hang that over somebody's head, or they don't mess with you. They just say they go after your family or somebody you care, or your mom, your dad, whatever. I'm just saying, yeah, man, when the Civil Rights Movement came, see, I was around when the Civil Rights Movement came along. And what I'm saying, I saw when the dogs was being, turned loose on people and a good bottle catch you upside the head, and knock your teeth out, whatever. All I'm just saying you is when you see how what we call, what's these operations when you say it becomes a police state. History does one thing. If it doesn't do anything else, it repeats itself. And it is people that do want to try to stand up, but what happens, man, things can break you. And like you guys, like you're on the station of Just Cause, and we got stations like this around the country and people trying to talk about the issues. I get calls all the time, man, from people that just got railroaded in the most horrid way you could think of. You say, how did that happen? But I don't have to ask it because I know how it happens.
Yeah.
And it is a fight, man. It's a never-ending battle. And me as a cop, I'm with an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP. LEAP.cc, LEAP.org. Y'all go up on there and look at it. But I'm saying to you, my motto is injustice for all. But again, when you're talking about, man, taking on the whole institution, most of the time, most of the people, even though they know when they see things aren't right, they don't want to get involved. Because they understand, they see the examples that are made, and so they just rather just say and hope and pray it doesn't happen to them until one day that car comes around the corner and slams into them, or cancer shows up, or something happens in their life that they wish that it wasn't them.
That's right.
And they wish that everybody would come together and support them. But we see, when I went forward, man, let me tell you something. I ended up, man, I mean, I'll never forget when I was going into that courthouse, man, and I'm getting ready to go to trial. And I'm in a position where they're, everybody was ducking, and they were giving me the power sign from at least 20 feet away. They weren't even standing. And then they hide it and cover it up and fall, go get them and everything. But they saw me as going to get crucified. And if it wasn't for my God, man, and for my belief system and me saying, Lord, now you sent me, if I go down, I know it's only, they can't put a hand on me, but it's because of you. And when that jury came back, said, we find in the civil action of Matthew Falk versus the mighty U.S. Department of Justice, we find that you violated 13 out of 14 of its civil rights. We order you to reinstate it from an inspector to a GS-15 chief deputy U.S. Marshal. We order you to pay all his attorney fees, and we order you to pay him $4 million. Everybody jumped up and went running. But that wasn't the part that brought the tears down my eyes. What got me the tears that rolled down my face was when that jury said, and we also find that because of all evidence that we've heard here in this 20 days of trial, we find the whole U.S. Marshal Service, from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., from Houston, Texas to Maine, to be a racial, hostile environment for all of its African-American deputy United States Marshals. That's when the tears rolled down my face. Because at that moment, I knew me going alone and standing in there, standing in the gap, the Lord came to me in a voice in his mind. He said, Matthew, remember that night when you got evicted? you got cut out because you couldn't pay your rent. You said, everybody's abandoned me now. He said, well, now you two have become the stone the builders rejected. And what I say to your audience is, we have to be willing to become the stone the builders rejected. Because until we can get like that, until we get it in our mind that this is a culture and we have to be part of keeping history from repeating itself, it will repeat itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
All those things we
and
sorry,
I want to
get y'all get me stirred up. Mm-hmm.
No, we good. We want you stirred up. But I have a question that, you know, in the case of the IRP 6, they
right.
are, you know, when people go to prison, they say, okay, you got to pay restitution back, this and this and that.
Right.
Well, in this situation, with this case being against staffing companies and they saying, well, they owe restitution, the staffing companies have written it off, have gotten a tax break. I talked to an owner
right.
of a staffing company this week, and he said there's no way that any restitution would go back to the staffing companies. They wouldn't touch it because then they would have to deal with the IRS because they already got a tax break. So if you can talk to us, if you have any information about, okay, if the restitution is not going to the person that they claim is, is
the
quote-unquote
mm-hmm.
victim,
mm-hmm.
then what happens with that money? I mean, where is the pot of money that the federal government is holding on to, and who is that paid to? Now you chuckling, so I'm ready.
Well, first thing, from the way it sounded, these guys, they couldn't make any restitution anyway, right?
Right.
They
taking like their wives' tax returns. And, you know, the pennies they make, they're working, you know, in their so-called job in the federal prison. They taking that and saying they applying that to restitution.
Right.
But who's the money
going to? Man, to be honest, that little bit of money is probably just going right back into the institution. I couldn't tell you specifically. I'm not in a – I mean, I don't know when you come down to that would fall under some I can't think of the term I want to use. The acquisition, the way they would turn those dollars over, I couldn't begin to tell you how they're doing that. I mean, I know they do. Government does make you pay restitution, and it's supposed to go to certain things. But now, when you tell me what details, once somebody gets convicted, that would be interesting. A procurement, it would be interesting to see where. You know, restitution, where the money actually goes, where it's earmarked when it does, because I don't know, I'll be honest with you.
But they
use that, you're right, that's the last straw to break you down, is once you've been convicted, then they break you financially. And at that point, they literally try to, as a black man, you become another slave. Most white folks got institutional history to, you know, foundations that can help them. Most African Americans, we still carry the names of our slave owners. So, I mean, the bottom line is, no, we most of the time, if you're not broken once you go to prison, or if they make you pay restitution, you're about done.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
It's that's just what happens to you. It's sad,
okay.
Man. It's sad because it we look at places like we talk about, you know, police states and Hitler and. And we talk about all kinds of things in history and Mussolini, and we go to the country, we bomb the heck out of countries, and we try to make Saddam Hussein and all these other nations look like they were terrible people. All you got to do is run a history check on us, man. And you
there
see some real, some real terrible stuff.
Oh, yeah, you see some real gangsters right here,
yes,
calling
indeed.
Them the federal government.
Yeah.
Matt, we appreciate you joining us tonight, man. It's been very insightful. The things that you have to that you said, and like again, I want to say we appreciate your service, all the times you put yourself in harm's way, and you know, put your family through it, hoping and praying that you came home that night.
Matthew
right,
Fogg,
right.
Retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal, joining us this evening, and we appreciate it again. Appreciate you taking a couple of nights out of
you. And let them know if they need a guest speaker. Let them know I'm a guest speaker in a lot of places I speak, so they can Google me if they need me as a guest speaker. I go all over the country speaking, on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we actually are talking about doing some panels and stuff like that in the future. So We will definitely keep that in mind. And we're going to post some information about you out on our website. And so
okay.
folks can go out there and be able to reach you. And then they can also, you know, check our archives and be able to listen to this program and hear some additional information about, or if they missed some of the earlier broadcasts that we were talking to you, then they can go back out and listen to that. So, again, the IRP6, Ethel, how can folks help us out as far as the IRP6 are concerned? And you know, folks can go out to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org.
Yes.
They can read everything that they ever wanted to read about this case and bring themselves up to speed. But that main thing about the over 200 pages of transcript that's missing
is to call Eric Holder's office at 202-514-2003 and 2005.
And then also, you know, coming up on this next Wednesday and for the last 3 weeks, Cliff, you and I have actually been on PRN.FM. That's Progressive Radio Network with Utris Lead, Lead Store. You know, she is helping to dissect this story right all the way from the beginning to the end. And Utris is just, you know, I love her interview style. And she's helping to expose the injustice in the IRP6 case. She's helping us to get the story out there. And so look at our website and follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. On Twitter, we're putting out all the time as far as upcoming broadcast schedules and all that kind of stuff. So, Cliff, what do you got?
Absolutely. I want to say thank you to everybody in the chat room. We appreciate input to our guests in studio, Mr. Amos Clark, briefly of IRP Solutions. We appreciate you coming out joining us. Mr. Matthew Fogg, Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal. Thank you for your service once again, my brother. And to our production crew, we got Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson, K&D Productions, helping out Ill Skillers Girl in the control room. To our support staff for AJC Radio, we couldn't do it without you guys. And to the truth, we know you're out there.
And
we appreciate it.
To Olivia Hodges and Miss Barbara Johnson and also the rest of the Just Cause team.
And like we talked about earlier, hey, go to a-justcause.com, a-justcause.com. Click that donate button. Click the donate button. We want to, you know, if you believe in what we're doing, join in. Gary Walker, Dave Zappolo, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, Kendrick Barnes, pray for the IRP6.
Happy birthday, Gary Walker.
Yeah,
happy birthday.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Absolutely.
Good night, America.
Good night.